It's time for conversations about our food and how it's grown on Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.
We're all affected by trends in the food industry, whether or not we're farming or we're just ordering things at a restaurant, or we've got a restaurant or we've got a store. What's going on? Well, I'll tell you, my guest today makes it a living of looking at patterns and identifying what's coming down the road. And I'm really happy to welcome Susie Badaracco. Susie's the president of Culinary Tides. Susie, I really appreciate your taking the time to talk to us. Now, you have a business where you identify patterns that are taking place. Did I say that right? I mean, it's more than just trends. I mean, we do trends, but when you look on your website, you talk about you and your team can see what's going on and look at a lot of information and recognize appropriate patterns. Is that right?
Yeah, so it's not enough just to be able to say what the next trend is. We have to be able to tell people what the birth parents are, where it's coming from, and then where it's going next. And then if it shifts, we also have to tell them when it's going to shift and what that's going to look like.
Well, that might be why you've identified your latest report. You call it Shifting Sands.
Exactly.
So there's a storm in the desert, apparently.
In the ocean.
Oh, in the ocean.
Like on the beach is the storms a-coming.
Well, that's another phrase that I saw that you had. You talked about looking beyond the breakers. So
yes.
That's the ocean view of it, too. So it's there's more out there. I mean, the people that are good surfers see a swell coming from a long ways out and get these reports that they're swells that will be a breaker, you know, hours and hours or days later than
exactly.
When the swells. So are you doing that? Are you seeing these swells that are going to become food breakers?
Yeah, so we're the clients we work for, we're consistently looking out 2 years ahead at all times.
Wow.
So we don't live in the present. We're actually living 2 years ahead.
So how's that going for you? I mean, the scary part of that is that every 2 years you can look back and say, well, did we get it or didn't we?
Oh, we do. Because that's the great part about the nature of our work with chaos theory and military analytics is we're constantly watching it. So if there's anything that's shifting, which is why that report's called Shifting Sands, we will catch it ahead of time. So that's the trick, is to gently change, keep up with course corrections. What you run into problems with is if you, look at a trend and then don't look at it again for another year. Mm-hmm. And you'll find it's in a different place or has a different personality or has a different best friend because you've not been watching it for a year. So we are constantly watching it day in and day out, all different trends, that we're keeping up with it. So the two-year trajectory is just slightly altered as we go along, so there aren't any surprises.
Well, you put a couple phrases out there I think we should back up and talk about a little bit, and then let's jump in and have some examples of some of the trends you've seen and some of the trends you see coming right now. But you said something called military analytics. Did I get that right?
Yes. So with forecasting, most industries are used to business intelligence. So they use business models. So like statistical models, like bar charts and pie charts and, interviewing consumers and then saying, okay, if nothing changes 5 years out, here's where that trend is going to be. That's linear analytics. It's business analytics.
Mm-hmm.
What we do is we do military analytics, which are chaos-driven. They're not statistical-driven. So it's a completely different way to look at things. But it's exactly how you would, piece together a crime scene and then figure out where that burglar is going to hit next.
Well, one more thing I need to ask you about then. You say chaos-driven, which I feel like I'm chaos-driven more than half the time. But in this case, when you talk about being chaos-driven, there's just a whole bunch of stuff that's going on that presents itself to you as some kind of pattern that you can identify that it's that it's a pattern, even though it doesn't look like it's linear, one leading to the other?
Exactly. So it's looking more three-dimensionally at forces that will impact a trend. So, for instance, what we're watching daily for the food industry is we're watching all government, technology, adversary and ally, competitors, all research, so consumer research, industry research, we're watching all food and flavor trends, all at the same time.
Wow.
So that's chaos. So we're collecting over 1,200 quantitative reports and industry events a month. And then we have to sort through that chaos, because that's a lot of information, to be able to pull out patterns that are specific to all of our clients. So a beverage company's pattern for the month will be radically different than, let's say, a snack company's pattern that we pull out from the same chaos.
So if you look at what you've accomplished in the last couple of years, could you give me an example of something that we all might recognize today as a situation that we're in, a trend that, you know, the average person might recognize that maybe 2 years ago you saw it coming?
Sure. So back in 2008, we forecasted, we predicted that Southern food was going to be coming up around 2000, and it's still here. We still have chicken and waffles, and we still have, Ozark cuisine, Appalachian cuisine is coming online. We've got Cajun Creole that's already spread nationwide. We've got Low Country cuisine, shrimp and grits that spread a couple of years ago nationwide. We also, around 2012, when we were coming out of the recession, we knew street food was going to be hot. Street food is another trend this year that's still going strong. So there's several that we've watched years and years ago that we predicted on and can still watch and forecast on. So like this year, for example, both of those trends are still going to be here again.
You know, Susie, I remember talking to you. It's been over a year, I think, we had a conversation, and you were talking about these things happening.
Mm-hmm.
And then, in this last year, I've been recognizing it more and more. I've been going to different restaurants that I've been seeing, you know, the Southern style food more and more. I mean, which I wouldn't have expected to be happening because, you know, like fried chicken and mashed potatoes and grits and things like that just doesn't seem to be going the direction when you look at all of the health concerns that have been expressed. I wouldn't have seen it coming, but I do see it in the restaurants, and you do see lots and lots more street food type of places that are popping up all over the country. So I recognize what you're saying. I wouldn't have thought that when I heard you say that, you know, back in the beginning.
Well, and also restaurants are doing things now like launching street food offerings, even though they're in a restaurant setting. So there's all sorts of ways to play within a trend. So we've had restaurants also launch food trucks, you know, based on the restaurant. So there's all sorts of ways. You don't have to just be in the street food scene. It absolutely can be adopted by restaurants, and even retailers could put out street food offerings like in the frozen section.
Does that happen? I mean, are you seeing that retailers as well as restaurants are following these trends and trying to jump in front with either carry out a I'm not sure where how else they might be doing it, or even their choice of what foods that they're putting in the store, whether they're...
Oh, absolutely. Kind of the poster child, I would say, is probably street tacos.
Ah.
And street tacos, you know, you can find that everywhere. You can find that in Qdoba and, you know, a lot of the fast casuals. But they're the little tiny soft tacos that, you know, are practically 2-bite size. Those are the little street tacos that... And they've been out for years now, right? They've been out. But that's how street food went from the food truck kind of into the fast casual scene, for example.
You know, with the United States having these patterns, are you doing it just in the United States, or what you're doing, does it apply to Canada too?
Yeah, we watch them worldwide. So what happens is nothing happens in a vacuum. So trends come from somewhere. They don't just materialize. So let's say there's a certain pattern we're watching in the U.S. that's occurring. You might see a shadow of the same pattern happening in Europe or happening in Asia or happening in Canada. It won't be exactly the same, but it'll be a cousin. It'll be Europe's version of street food or Canada's version of street food, for example. So you can see these patterns kind of float around the countries. some stick harder in certain countries than others. Again, it depends on what that country's consumers are doing at the time, what the politics are, what their economy's doing, to see if that trend could show up or not show up. So part of our job, too, is just figuring out if a trend could show up in a different country or not. Sometimes they don't work.
You know, years ago, I remember that some of the large food companies were focusing on, especially Scandinavia, it seems to me, that there were certain things they thought started in Scandinavia and then showed up in the rest of Western Europe and maybe more Northern Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And then it would be on both coasts of the United States and then kind of move its way into the middle.
So actually, it's called the Nordic trend. The Nordic trend actually started in the middle and then went outwards, because the press thinks it started on the outsides, but it didn't. It really started in Minnesota. And the reason it started in Minnesota was because that's where our Scandinavian population is.
Sure, sure.
So it has all the bakeries, it's got all the crazy dishes, because it's been there. Then press got a hold of it, and they're like, oh, look, it's in New York and California. But really, it's been sitting strongest in the upper Midwest.
Well, now,
that's where it's really birthplace was.
Yeah. So now, does the same thing apply to the South? I mean, that it would make sense that it might.
The South really started literally like in the diners in the South. It didn't start in high-end restaurants. That's the other thing people sometimes think, a trend starts in high-end restaurants and works its way down. It rarely happens that way. The movement started in the diners, but then what took the Deep South national was fast food. McDonald's was literally the first one in with their breakfast Southern chicken sandwich. This is way back in like 2008. Took it national. And then we have a whole timeline of this occurring. Then all these other fast foods jumped on it and started launching national. Then eventually it went high-end. So eventually, a couple of years ago, you said you saw like fried chicken go into beautiful high-end restaurants. But really, fast food was the one that took that at a national level, and then it kind of could move from there. So what Southern food is doing now is it's going more regional. So you started with Cajun Creole, then you started hearing about Low Country cuisine with shrimp and grits, then you started hearing about Appalachian cuisine, and now we're into Ozark cuisine. So it's kind of moving its way up and getting more regionalized. So when a trend occurs, it kind of occurs in its baby form. So you just hear Southern food. You don't know anything about Southern food. It's like Southern food. And then as consumers get more educated and the trend continues, it has nowhere else to go but to start getting more sophisticated and regionalized. So then consumers get more educated and more sophisticated around how to play with that trend as well.
So I would imagine that, say, Mexican food is so old now. I mean,
yeah.
You know, I remember you couldn't find Mexican food when I was growing up in central Illinois, but then now it's everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything that can still be new about a broad area like
yes.
Mexican food?
So Mexican, again, that's kind of broad. That's an entire country. So Mexican is now going regional. So you don't want to, like, if someone's going to produce Mexican food, you don't want to just say it's Mexican food. You want to make sure you know what part of Mexico that is coming from and that it's a specific regional dish, let's say. That's where the direction is going. And now, really, this year, what's happening is other Central American countries are going to start coming into the limelight, too. So maybe Panama, Costa Rican food. And it's really occurring in the cocktail scene, actually, who's kind of leading the charge for more of Central America to come forward. But that's the direction. You start with Mexico, now you go regional Mexico, and then the next step is let other Central American countries have a voice. Right now, Mexico is kind of the only voice that Americans know. They don't know anything about Panamanian food or Costa Rican food. But the bar scene does. And if you go to the bar scene, there are cocktails coming out of different parts of Central America. There's different beers coming out of different parts of Central America. So they're ahead of the food game right now. The beverage is leading that. And so even if you're in food, you're wise to watch beverage also, because sometimes a trend can courier over from a different part of the food industry and enter your part of the food industry and create a trend.
How do you explain things like kimchi tacos? I mean, you've seen these, you know, combining Korean and
yes.
Mexican, and it seems like it started in Los Angeles, it appeared to.
So that's part of the hybrid trend. So the reason it occurred, the reason it went national, like it was going to occur because that chef was going to do that, because he loves doing that. The reason it got attention and went national is because it happened at the time when we were coming out of the recession into the recovery. And one of the first stages in recovery that happens for the food industry is we go from comfort food, which is, let's say, pasta or Mexican food. It's singular, it's simple, it's comforting. You go into a mode of hybrids and stuffed phenomenon. So a hybrid is the one you exactly mentioned. You're kind of taking two different things and you're putting them together. The step after that is fusion, and actually your example is better fits with fusion, where you take two things that aren't very likely to be together and you fuse them, which is exactly what that chef did.
Well, that chef did, but now there's food trucks kind of all over the country, and they're doing the same thing.
Exactly. It's that fusion. So you kind of go from comfort to hybrids, so the poster child for hybrid a couple of years ago was the cronut, croissant, and donut. Two comforty things. You put them together, you've got this hybrid.
So
the fusion of different cuisines is kind of the next level of sexy.
So if you go to your food truck and they are starting to offer you meatloaf, mashed potatoes, and green beans, you should call your broker and sell.
Yes, you should panic. And in fact, the report that we just launched is exactly showing that's the direction we're headed back to, unfortunately. We're not in a recession, but we are in an emotional stall in this country, it's called. So what consumers are doing is they're heading away from the sexy fusion and being really experimental, which is what they've been doing for the last couple of years, kind of heading that direction, which is confident, it's experimental, and they have pulled back starting last year and into this year. And there's not been an economic crisis, there's not a housing crisis, it's not economically driven, that's why it's called a stall. It's an emotional state. So there is enough fear for multiple reasons in this country, you know, storms that have happened, fires in California, you know, political things going on in this country. There's enough fear built now that we're slipped backwards. We're not seeing fusion. You won't see fusion this year being in the spotlight. You're going to shift back over to like hybrids. So there'll be some experimentation, but the base foods and the base drinks are going to be more in the comfort territory. And so we're absolutely sliding backwards this year.
Wow, that is so interesting. So if somebody is spending their whole day, you know, going back and forth and watching MSNBC and Fox and, you know, all these that keep them stirred up,
yeah,
they're more likely to go lean towards a meal that mom used to make them.
Exactly. That's exactly what's happened. And the report that we launched captured 149 other forecasters. It was 191 lists that we had to look at. All of them are in agreement. So some things are still experimental. So, for instance, in food, the experimental part, the little fun, flirty part, is the seasonings and the preps. So how you're preparing is kind of fun, and the seasonings are exotic. But the main food, like the vegetables or the fruits or maybe the meats, has pulled back to something more approachable, calmer, more comfortable. So, for example, like if you just take vegetables, we're pulling back to broccoli, beets, chicory, which is very historical to the South, heirloom vegetables, collard greens. There is nothing sexy. It's very earthy, very historic, very calming. But what you do to them is you make them fun and flirty because you're putting on Ethiopian spices. So that's how we're pulling back. We're kind of going in reverse. And same with the beverage area. The beverage area is the same way. It's the add-ins to the beverage, whether it's alcohol or non-alcohol, but the base beverage is either historical or just very calm and approachable for Americans right now.
What if we took something like Italian, which is in many mm-hmm. ways very traditional? So you've got plain old spaghetti and meatballs. I love it, but
yeah.
Or you got pizzas with marinara sauce and so forth. I mean, can you find it in the cuisine like that?
Yes.
Yeah, like the pendulum swings.
So those two are really great examples. So for instance, pasta, just pasta in general, is going to. So if you go out or if you even go to retail, you'll find hand-cut pasta. So that's how. So it's not. So you're not pulling all the way back to comfort, which would just be dried pasta with marinara sauce.
Right.
It's hand-cut pasta or handmade pasta. And then, again, the sauce would be like a very specific regional Italian sauce. Mm-hmm. So it wouldn't be, excuse me, as generic or comforty as just marinara sauce. It would be coming from, like, something from Sicily specifically. But it's on this lovely hand-cut pasta. So, it's not pulled all the way back to fringe or back to comfort. And with pizza, you mentioned pizza. One of the styles of pizza right now that's kind of being talked about that not many are very familiar with, it's a little more fringe, is a Detroit-style pizza. So, again, it's pizza. So we've pulled back fully to pizza, but it's not just New York-style or Chicago, which maybe more people know about. It's this other style of pizza that's, you know, a little bit more unknown to the country. And that's how you keep pizza kind of sexy.
Yeah, it's kind of unknown to me. I mean, you know any examples of what might be in a Detroit pizza? They got thicker crust or thinner crust or more?
So it's usually a deep dish, mm-hmm. and it's square.
Oh.
Those are kind of two of the characteristics. If you talk about, like, Detroit-style pizza, it's going to be deep dish, it's going to be square, it's not going to be round.
You know, one of the things that you said I want to go back to, and that is kind of the trend with, like, say, vegetables, fruits and vegetables in particular, because you were saying, like, maybe more basics. You can do other things with them,
mm-hmm.
but for a while, I know we've been, you know, seeing a lot of the farmers markets and farms that are thinking that they've got to have 25 different types of leafy greens. And,
yeah.
and that sort of thing. And so what I'm wondering whether you're suggesting that that shrinks back to.
Yeah, it will shrink back, and it will, like, honestly, if you have greens, I would make sure I've got microgreens mixed in and heirloom greens mixed in. Doesn't matter what the green is. Like, dark leafies are always a good place to be. You know mm-hmm. what I mean? But what the consumer is for comfort, what they're looking for is heirloom, because that's historical. It keeps you kind of grounded.
Mm-hmm.
We're pulling back, actually, back to, like, dandelion again. Mm-hmm. Dandelion was, you know, a weed, right? But it was kind of fun and flirty coming out of the recession. Like, everybody was like, ooh, dandelions. Now we're back to dandelions. Like, we kind of passed dandelions. Now we're back there.
What about fruits? Would the same thing apply to fruits?
So, yeah, the difference with fruits are when we were kind of going full bore a couple of years ago into recovery and everybody's kind of feeling good and all that, you saw a lot more deep south, not even our country, like South America. You saw acai and goji berries coming onto the market and, you know, lots of pomegranate, and we grow pomegranate here too. But they were all... there were a lot of fruits that were not from this country, right?
Yes.
And now this year, you still have some of that, but most of the fruits are going back towards historical American fruits. So, for instance, you've got some of the sexy ones, but then you go back to, like, varietal limes, like kaffir lime. You've got jackfruit, which is coming in from overseas, but jackfruit is extremely mellow, bland profile. It is not sour. It's nothing. It's very adaptable. You've got fig, very historical to this country. Dates. Coconut, obviously, was a couple years ago. Coconut's back again. Bananas, avocado, apricot. Varietal apples and pears. So for their apples and pears, which are exceptionally common, you want to kind of go varietal, right? So you'll see that in the cider market. You'll see that in the bakery market, everybody's going kind of variety. It's not just apple pie, right? It's Fuji or whatever the apple is. But same thing at the farmers markets. They'll be looking for varietals. They'll be looking for heirlooms. The imperfect and ugly produce is you know, a great little trend that's still here, because again, it's celebrating, you know, kind of, you know, those who just don't fit in, right? So that's where our mental state is. But now we're applying it to produce. And so that's where the fruit's going. Melons, I mean, it's all kind of pulling back to what we already know. Persimmon, papaya, things that already grow here. Berries, but our berries, not the crazy berries. Blueberries, you know, those kind of things. That's where the fruit's kind of pulling back.
What are the implications for these trend changes? What are the implications, say, for example, farmers markets? Are people more or less inclined to be, you know, going to shop locally at farmers markets? Or?
No, they are, because actually local, like the trend of local and the trend of seasonal, this is going to sound very sad, but it's actually a fear behavior that consumers do. So when they are in a fearful position for whatever reason, stall, economic crisis, whatever, they go into a fearful position, they get more controlling on everything in their life, right? Because there's fear in their life. And so they are more likely to go to farmers markets and shop local because it gives them a sense of control. They can see and meet who grew the vegetables. It's a very attractive. That's why coming out of the recession, farmers markets just jumped, because it's a fearful position for consumers to be in, and so they're attracted to that.
Well, apparently the economy has been fairly strong lately, but still people are fearful. Maybe it's all these other uncertainties that you talked
about
earlier.
That's what I mean. So we know it's not a recession because nothing economic has happened. There's no housing crisis or anything like that. It's a stall. It's called a stall. And it means that consumers behave similar to what they do in a recession, not as extreme, but similar, same pattern, lighter pattern. But we know there's no economic underneath crisis that has caused it. We know there's these other factors that have caused it. That's why it's a stall, not a recession behavior. So that's why they've only pulled partway back. So they've not gone all the way back to comfort food. They've just pulled partway back.
So that fearful issue, that it makes me think about when people go to restaurants then. Is that the reason that you see the same more and more? They're describing how the food was produced or what farm it came from. Is that meeting that need?
Yes, exactly. That's how it would translate into the restaurant scene. Is, again, if you're going out to a restaurant, whatever can make that consumer feel kind of grounded and, you know, in control and safe. And by doing that, you'd, on the menu, be kind of describing what is the varietal apple in that pie, or, you know, maybe is that broccoli grown local? That would be very attractive right now to a consumer in a restaurant to have that piece of information, because it's very grounding for them. It makes us calmer to understand kind of where the food is coming from, how it was prepared.
So you're looking at patterns. So are you saying that maybe 2 years from now, there'll be as much or more of that sort of description, you know, connection taking place?
It depends. It depends. If we're still, hopefully we're not, but if we're still in a fearful position in 2 years, like still in this stall type behavior, then, yeah, the pattern would still be here. What would 2 years out, what would change is which regional cuisines are kind of in the spotlight, or
sure,
which dark green is in the spotlight, but it's still going to be dark greens. Do you know what I mean? So
sure,
the pattern's going to be there. It's who's the leading lady versus the best friend. That's what would change 2 years out.
So what are you going to do if you're a company, or even a small company or a big company, and you're making your own marinara sauce, or it could be a large company that's selling
mm-hmm.
marinara sauce to, you know, supermarket chains.
Yeah.
How do you capitalize on that trend? Is there anything you do in your marketing or in the flavor or labeling or any of that stuff to try to be sure that your products are positioning in that trend?
Yeah, so if you're in retail and you're looking at a whole wall of marinara sauces, to set yourself apart, you could do a few different things. You would either have it be marinara, but then have the spice profile be unique, something a little bit different, like I'm trying to think
of
a good
you were
example.
Saying earlier, different regions and
exactly, exactly. You can either regionalize the sauce itself. So marinara in Sicily is going to be different from marinara, you know, in Umbria.
Uh-huh.
Right? They're going to be two different things. And so you would be, if you're already making it in that style, make sure you call that out, that it's not just marinara. We're actually doing it in this style of marinara. The greatest thing you could do is come out with a whole line of marinaras from all different parts of Italy. Do you know what I mean? That way you can attract everybody. Like, you're shopping for marinara. Now I've got 3 or 4 or 5 different marinaras to pick from the same company I love. But I can try it from all different regions of the country.
Well, and that even gets back, though, to your point of trying to be able to identify things in the country as well. So, I mean, you could stay with marinara for a minute here. You could say all the different marinaras that are from tomatoes grown in Oregon, you know,
Yeah, exactly. If it's local, absolutely. I would call out, like, you know, if the tomatoes or the ingredients are coming from a certain spot.
If people want to know more about what you do with Culinary Tides, where do they find you?
So our website is www.culinarytides.com. And then we also have, we actually just put up a brand new Facebook under the same Culinary Tides. And then Twitter, same feed. And then, you know, I myself am on LinkedIn. But we have all of those little guys connected now so that if we tweet something out, it goes everywhere.
And again, it's Susie Badaracco, and Badaracco, Susie.
Yes.
Susie, I want to just ask you one kind of wrap-up question.
Sure.
So with all this stuff that you were privy to, you're seeing all these reports and you're doing all this analysis, what are a couple of things that really tickle your fancy right now? I mean, you think that whether or not it's going to be exciting to anyone that might be a client of yours, but if you look ahead, what have you seen in all that you're digesting that you really are intrigued with?
Oh, see, it's let me think about that for a second. Right now we've been so preoccupied with the backslide. It's like, no, don't do that. I think what I actually really love is some of the technologies that are coming out. So I love watching, for instance, the evolution of plant protein trend. So all the little, so right now there's infighting between animal proteins and plant proteins, which is fascinating to us because rarely do you have a segment fighting within itself.
Mm-hmm.
But you do. And now there's all these little technologies for plant proteins like chickpea flour and banana flour just got launched. So all these little fun ways for plant proteins to move into territories animal protein just can't get. Like they can move into chips and bars, cereal, you know, places like beef can't really move or easily move, right? But it's still protein. So the infighting between those two segments are kind of very interesting to watch. I always akin them to, like, if you were at a party, animal protein and plant protein would be in the corner of the party arguing and probably drunk. You know? It's like, so I always picture them that way, right? The other thing I love watching is the grain category. So whole grains, it's just this little powerhouse. And if you're at the same party, the whole grains are either the host of the party, everybody loves them, or they're the guy you want to always invite to your party, and he brings you a bottle of wine and maybe an appetizer, and he just has the best stories. That would be whole grains, right? And so it's always fun to see, but like then whole grains, for instance, you have someone always stepping into the spotlight who's different every year or so. So right now the single grains are in the spotlight, like teff, freca. You know, quinoa was a couple years ago, but quinoa's kind of back because we slid backwards. So with fruits and vegetables, too, it's sort of like it's always fun to see or try to figure out who's going to be in the spotlight. And what's fun this year and complicated this year is for fruits and vegetables, remember a couple years ago when kale was the darling of the vegetable world, right?
Yes.
Everybody needed kale in their salad and everywhere else. Okay, and then you had cauliflower and cauliflower steak. That was another little darling. This year, there is no darling for fruits and vegetables. There's entire gangs that are coming to the party, right? It's not just a little, it's the gang that's coming to the party. So that's why with greens, for example, you don't hear about a kale. You just hear dark greens. So chicories, collard greens, everybody's kind of on an equal footing. Same with fruit. You don't hear, there's not really a darling this year. There's heirloom, right? So as long as you're heirloom, you're a rock star. As long as you're one of the varietal apples, varietal pears, it doesn't matter which varietal. Just that you're a varietal makes you a little rock star. So what that does for industry, but it also does for farmers, it does for farmers markets, is it gives you breathing space. It gives you breathing space to do what you do well, and you don't have to, as long as you fit kind of in the broader segments that are affecting consumers, like heirloom, you know, kind of more approachable, you have more room to breathe and to play at what you do well. Same with grains. Grains are the same thing. There's six different single grains. It's not just one quinoa rock star this year. There's a whole multitude of them. So I think it gives you a lot more room and a lot more playground, you know, to be able to experiment with, no matter what part of the food industry you're in.
Well, would it apply to, say, like nuts instead of almonds or walnuts or macadamias, that people can just, you know, eat more nuts? And
Yeah, exactly, because the thing about nuts is that every nut has a different profile, right, like different flavor profile, different. So they kind of shine in different dishes. So one nut might excel in Indian cuisine, which is kind of a newer trend for the United States. But another one might shine better in, you know, Middle Eastern cuisine, who's been here a little bit longer. Mm-hmm. And then each of the nuts could have a different best friend. So one nut could pair better with dark greens or chickpeas. A different nut might be getting better along with fruits. So they can kind of stand out and shine all by themselves without having to directly compete with the other nuts, as long as they've found the right best friend to play with.
Oh.
And then they all have great health attributes, but slightly different health attributes, right? So mm-hmm. Some are more heart healthy. Some are better for maybe cognitive function. Some maybe are great paired, you know, in weight loss diet. Like, you know, there's just slightly different health profiles to all of them.
Boy, I tell you what, that's a lot to think about. I keep saying there's just one more thing, but when you look at all of this, you're looking at the broad trends that are taking place. Does the mix of millennials versus, you know, boomers and so forth, does it vary much, or are they pretty much, do these trends kind of float in and out of these various generations and aren't really generational, you know, specific?
So the macro pattern of this fear behavior that everyone's kind of pulling back into closer towards comfort is all generations. That's absolutely affecting absolutely all generations. The nuances between the generations then show up pretty clearly, and we track generational differences across all of this stuff. But so let's say Gen Z is below millennials. So Gen Z is like the 6-year-olds to like about 18 or so, right? So that's kind of the high school, middle school, that generation. Alpha Gen's the little teeny ones, but let's say Gen Z. Gen Z is wildly different in behavior than millennials, who are Gen Y, who are the next age. So they're, you know, 20-ish to 35-ish. Those two generations operate completely different. So, for instance, Gen Z, the littler ones, they are entirely sustainable driven. They will spend more money, but buy fewer sustainable, like organic, let's say, food, but they will buy organic. Gen Y will not. If they're worried about anything and they're in a money crunch, they're going to abandon sustainable products to an extent for price.
Wow.
So they operate wildly differently. The other thing about those two gens is Gen Z is more, the littler ones, are much more brand loyal. So if they like a brand, They will stick with that brand. Doesn't matter, good times, bad times. Gen Y will not. Gen Y will flit to other brands for any number of reasons. They're not. They don't tend to be brand loyal. And if they are, if they do like a brand, it tends to be their parents' brand that the parents like, not what they picked.
Wow.
So they're wildly different. Both of those younger generations tend, because of where they are in life, they tend to. Everybody thinks they tend to be more experimental with food, but research has shown it's boomers who are actually the most experimental with trying new foods. Mm-hmm. Nobody knows that, or nobody thinks that. There's this thing that, oh, they're younger, so they'll experiment more with crazier flavors. It's not true. It's actually boomers that do that. One of the older generations does that. And so it's fascinating because consumers think, oh, I'm young, I'm crazy. It's like, you know what? Actually, your grandparents, they're the ones that are experimenting with the foods and flavors.
Well, that's fascinating. And it also, if you look at this youngest generation that you're talking about, then look down the road and how they feel about sustainability and that they can be loyal to a brand, well, a company ought to be paying attention to that. They're going to grow up and start buying a lot of groceries someday or going out to eat a lot.
Yeah, exactly. And right now they spend a really large portion of the money they do have, even though they might only be 18 or younger, on food specifically, because they don't have really rent or anything else left. You know, they're still with mom and dad. The reason they're sustainably driven, that generation, Gen Z, is because they're the first generation born into sustainability. So they don't know how not to recycle.
Yeah.
When they were born, everybody was recycling. Millennials don't have that background. Millennials, sustainability issues kind of came when they were already
sure
on their way. Gen Z was born into it, so they only know organic produce in the grocery store and in the farmers. They don't know anything else. That's why they're committed to sustainability, because they don't understand it. Weren't born into a world without it.
Susie, this is so exciting, and I really appreciate this conversation. And I could go on and on and on, but I usually don't let the podcast go quite that long. Yeah, it's fun talking to you too, because not only are you talking about these trends, you had a fun way of looking at it. I mean, you start this whole thing by looking at the beach, and then you keep mentioning that there's a playground or a party ahead.
Exactly. We're on the playground. We're at the party.
I know.
Well, it helps to talk, honestly, when I was a criminalist, testifying in court on crime scenes, we were actually trained to talk in metaphors so that you could get an image across very quickly to a lay jury, for example. So I apologize, but I still talk in metaphors.
You know what? These are great metaphors, and they're all nice metaphors. You worried me when you started talking about the criminal experience. I thought we might slip into a not-so-nice metaphor.
No. We still have fun metaphors back then, too. You know, going to the laundromat. You know, we have very silly metaphors for that, too.
Yeah, well, I prefer playgrounds and parties.
Exactly. So exactly. The beach, the ocean.
Yeah, I tell you what, Susie Badaracco, I really appreciate your being on Farm to Table Talk and sharing your playgrounds and parties with us.
Okay, well, thank you.
You've been listening to Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.